The 2024 F-150 Lightning truck gets dirty and runs clean. With an EPA estimated range of 320 miles with the available extended range battery, it's the only electric vehicle that's an F-150. Visit Ford.com/F-150Lightning to learn more. Excludes Platinum models. EPA estimated driving range based on full charge. Actual driving range varies with conditions such as external environment, vehicle use, vehicle maintenance, high voltage, battery age, and state of health.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/save. Whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
On Tuesday night, Tatish Netetta realized the election was breaking for Trump when Georgia and North Carolina began reporting results.
It sort of began to coalesce that he could win those two states, which were likely necessary for the Harris campaign. If she had lost any one of the 3 blue wall states.
Tatish is the director of the UMass poll and a political science professor at UMass Amherst. After looking at those early numbers, he began listening to what Democratic surrogates were saying on TV. To an expert like Tatish, it was a clear message.
You saw a number of Democratic strategists on MSNBC or CNN talking about their confidence that they could still win the election and that it's going to come down to these 3 Midwestern states.
Robert Costa's reporting that Jen O'Malley Dillon has now sent out a memo. She's the campaign manager for the Vice President Harris and says they still believe that the blue wall is the ultimate way to win.
Once I started hearing that, I thought this might be done.
At the end of the day, Trump didn't just win. He took most of the swing states. He won the popular vote. It wasn't really that close. That's something that might have surprised Americans looking at national opinion polling before Election Day. You look at opinion polls going into Tuesday, showed them more or less tied. I think you guys maybe had her up 2 points toward the end of October. Were all those polls wrong?
I don't know if they were wrong. I think one of the things that pollsters and polls attempted to communicate is that this is going to be an extremely close election. And it's going to come down to 2 factors. First, which candidate is going to be able to turn out their voters? And then secondarily, where do those voters who are on the fence, which side do they decide on in the last weeks and days before the election?
And just like in 2016, those last-minute voters went for Trump. What's more, Tatish says, that's actually not surprising if you dig into some other polling.
I think the surprising thing was the fact that Harris was unable to win any of those swing states, right? And so in some ways, that's a reflection of a national dynamic. The national dynamic was many voters were unhappy with the current administration, were unhappy in large part with the direction of the country. And that's what polling has been demonstrating over the course of months, if not years, that Americans are not okay with where the country is going and where it's been.
Today on the show, in a week where Americans are digging into percentages and exit polls and probably misunderstanding them, we're going to teach you how to do it the right way. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around. Have you heard about Doublenomics? It's okay if you haven't. It's extremely niche and practiced by Discover. Here's an example. Discover automatically doubles the cash back earned on your credit card at the end of your first year with Cashback Match. That means with Discover, you could turn $150 cash back to $300. It pays to Discover. See terms at discover.com/credit card. Your team members spend over half their time writing, and we all know how that happens. One confusing email turns into 12 confused replies, then a meeting to get aligned. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all the wasted time and money that goes with it. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly helps them gain buy-in and action through their communication. Grammarly helps you improve the substance, not just the style, of your writing by identifying exactly what is missing. Teams that communicate better with Grammarly report 25% faster time to resolution for support tickets and 52% less time writing sales emails, saving 19 days per year per employee. Grammarly works where you work, from docs to messages to emails. It integrates seamlessly across 500,000 apps and websites. No cutting, no pasting, no context switching. Equip your team with the gold standard of responsible AI. 15 years of experience, just about every IT certification, and never sells your data. Join 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to get results on the first try. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI. One of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you is to help listeners understand how polling works, because I think a lot of Americans just don't really understand it, despite the number of polls that we see all the time. I think a lot of people think of a poll as predictive. Like if they see 50 to 47, they think, oh, that means that candidate A has a 50% chance of winning. But that is not correct, right? Can you explain how it works to me?
The first thing I always say is that polls are not predictive. Polls are snapshots of where the public is at the moment in which the poll was in the field. And so polls should be used to explain first and foremost. And, you know, I always say pollsters and polls, they're not soothsayers. They can't tell you about the Ides of March and that Caesar is going to die. But what they can tell you is that Caesar is likely in trouble and that there are some indications that the person or people that are going to be a threat to him might be around him. And so they can explain, but they can't predict. They can't predict exactly what's going to happen.
Why do you think we have this consistent problem in understanding that?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, it's a reflection of the use of polls, at least political polls, in our societies.
Is that a media literacy problem, or is that on us, me, the media?
So the media, if you just look at the ways in which they employ polls, is to articulate that these are predictive, that this is what's going to happen, and that the polls are the best information that we can garner to predict, again, the future. And that is not ever pushed back by the polling organizations and the pollsters that appear on media shows and, you know, who have emerged as political pundits. They make the same sort of implicit and at times explicit claims that polls are predictive. But it's also pollsters, whether that's 538, whether that's pollsters you see on CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, they don't ever undermine the overarching argument that polls are not about prediction, they're about explanation. And, you know, there's also the lack of recognition that polls, again, are snapshots of where people are at, but events occur that can shift and change the ways in which the public sees elections, sees candidates. And so in this election cycle, there were so many distinct events that had these impacts on the public. So whether it's assassination attempts, whether it's the replacement of one candidate or the other, whether it's, you know, stand-up comedians making racist jokes about an entire nation state, you have these various events that have this impact on the way in which people see the election, see these elected officials, which then undermine the predictive quality of these polls.
Take me inside that, because I know that you have been polling during this cycle. Like, what do you do to get a poll out in the field when suddenly there's a new candidate? Suddenly one of the candidates has been the victim of an assassination attempt. Like, how do you change direction?
So in July, early July, we had a poll that was going to be in the field during the Republican National Convention and really get a sense of American sentiments regarding the Republican Party and President Trump and his selection for vice president. That poll was going to be in the field, and then an assassination attempt occurred with President Trump. We scrapped that poll and we pivoted towards a poll that focused on political violence and assassination attempts and what people think about the rhetoric that's been used in politics, whether that's the rhetoric regarding, you know, the threat that President Trump poses or the rhetoric sort of undermining at that moment in time President Biden's age and mental acuity. And so we then had that second poll ready to go. And in that same week, we find that President Biden decided to leave the race. And so you have again, another extremely important event. And then within minutes of leaving the race, then points to Vice President Harris as his successor. And so then we pivoted once again and started to focus our attention on assessments of Harris and a Harris versus Trump election and levels of emotions regarding this new matchup. And so this is a reflection of the quality of our team here at the UMass Poll, but it's, I think, pollsters more generally to be equipped to recognize when events occur, to then shift the focus of your poll, shift the focus of your questions to reflect the ways in which politics are being understood by the public at large.
When we come back, nobody picks up a phone anymore. How the tech behind polling is keeping up.
The 2024 F-150 Lightning truck gets dirty and runs clean. With an EPA estimated range of 320 miles with the available extended range battery, it's the only electric vehicle that's an F-150. Visit Ford.com/F-150Lightning to learn more. Excludes Platinum models. EPA estimated driving range based on full charge. Actual driving range varies with conditions such as external environment, vehicle use, vehicle maintenance, high voltage, battery age, and state of health.
Innovation is important to the future of many businesses, and processes need to be clear, fast, and ultimately more productive. Take a big step to solving these problems with the Innovation Workspace from Miro. The Innovation Workspace comes loaded with AI-enabled tools to help teams get from idea to output faster. Miro's Innovation Workspace will help your teams accelerate through the full innovation development cycle, helping them to be faster, more productive, and ultimately more effective. Its new AI-powered tools and features can visualize tasks ahead, condense documents to produce summaries in seconds, and even create complex diagrams and flowcharts using natural language. It's designed to complement and sync with existing apps and platforms you use every day, like Jira and Azure, so everything operates smoothly and easily, and everyone's on the same page to rapidly innovate, iterate, develop, and ship. Whether you work in innovation, product design, engineering, UX, Agile, or IT, bring your teams to Miro's revolutionary innovation workspace and be faster from idea to outcome. Go to Miro.com to find out how. That's Miro.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/campaign to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Tatish and the UMass Poll made a significant choice back in 2010. They decided to move away from telephone polling and go online.
And one of the great things about the internet in 2010 and even to today, it's much more efficient. It's much more effective, and it's also much more cheap. It's cost effective. And we made that decision early on, and it was not in line with the standard in the industry, yeah, which was still random digit dialing or face-to-face interviewing, which are both extremely expensive. And with technological change, in particular, the use of cell phones, the replacement of home phones and caller ID, you saw a lot of survey organizations which relied on random digit dialing beginning to recognize the challenges of getting representative samples, but also the challenges of getting individuals to respond because of caller ID. You know, I have a colleague here with the UMass poll, Alex Theodoritis, who says the technological shift to cell phones and to caller ID had a negative impact on two industries. The first industry is polling, but the second industry are phony phone calls. You have these sort of the notion that you don't have those anymore with caller ID. You just sort of say reject. And so we believe we were, again, trendsetters here because we have been relying on online polling since that provides representative, strong representative samples and a cost-effective way. And it's in line with the preferences that I think Americans tend to have also.
Yeah, nobody under the age of 30 answers their phone.
Exactly. And no one under the age of 30 has a home phone either. And so, again, it becomes very, very difficult to sort of go back to a point in time in which people are willing to answer their phones and also interested in answering their phones. And then even when they answer their phones, just to be frank, there is a, you know, issue in terms of trust and confidence in a number of various institutions, whether that is pollsters or higher education. And what you tend to find is a number of polling organizations are connected, like ours is, with universities. And we know that there's been a crisis of confidence in higher education. And so there are a lot of challenges associated with random digit dialing and with face-to-face interviewing that using online polling does not necessarily face in the same ways.
This might be a really stupid question, but like, how do you do an online poll? Give me the explaining it to my mom version.
So we actually are not the ones who do the online polling. So we farm out a lot of the polling to an organization, YouGov, which is one of the leading online pollsters, not just in the United States, but in the world. They have millions of people in their population or in their sample that are given points to then purchase various things based on the surveys that they take. What YouGov does is collect a sample of individuals from their population of respondents that are representative of demographic and political characteristics. They then weight that data to ensure the representativeness of the sample. And we are the ones who write the survey. We write the questions. We sort of order the questions in ways that make sense to respondents. And then we analyze the data when we get it back. And so, you know, much of the structure, much of the sort of, you know, nuts and bolts of it are farmed out to YouGov.
Is online polling reliable?
I would say it is. I mean, of course, it has its issues, as any form of polling or has. You know, one of the issues is the difficulty in ensuring a representative sample, ensuring that you provide the correct weights to reflect the population, to ensure that you, in your sample of respondents, have enough, you know, variation and diversity. And that's not just diversity in the sort of traditional sense of race or ethnicity or gender or religion, but diversity in terms of geography, diversity in terms of ideological and partisan understandings, diversity in terms of the level of political participation that allows for, again, the collection of a representative sample that then can make inferences and generalizations about where the public is.
In the aftermath of an election, you know, where we are in this particular moment now, we spend a lot of time poring over exit poll data. You know, okay, we're looking at this thing and it says 53% of white women voted for Trump.
Yeah.
You said earlier that exit polls are not always that reliable. How important is exit polling to trying to understand the minds of voters? And how much weight should we give it when we're trying to understand and tease out the threads of public behavior?
Yeah, so look, in the wake of what many feel is a surprising result, we are always looking for data that helps us to explain that result. And exit polls have been used historically to provide us with, as you know, quick data, a quick understanding of where the public is. But of course, it has problems. One of the central problems is that, and this is true more particularly in more recent races. So exit polls are done after people go to vote. And we know that there is a distinction in terms of those who decide to vote early or to vote by mail relative to those who vote on election day. And so those who vote on election day, at least in more recent elections, have been Republican. And we know the Republican Party tends to be made up of older folks, white folks, more well-off folks. And so you have in exit polling, as a result of the focus on same-day voting, a skew towards Republicans and an underestimation and underrepresentation of people of color, working-class folks as well. And so it's always very difficult to make inferences from exit polls for those types of groups because they just don't interview a lot of them. That being said, again, it provides us at least with an initial picture. But if you're looking for much better data in terms of who is voting and why they're voting, you got to wait until you get information from surveys that have validated voters. And that's just double-checking the registration and turnout of voters against those who are taking these surveys. Or you could look to the AP vote cast again, which is a much more high quality set of data.
I mean, one of the things I'm hearing in your voice is like, you need patience here and you need data. And Americans are not real good sitting around and waiting.
No, we have no patience. And so this week since Tuesday night has been a cavalcade of explanations about what happened and who is to blame, at least those who are attempting to explain what happened who lean left, support the Democratic Party. And what you're finding is individuals looking to, whether it's Latino men or white women or white people in general, or women in general, to try to explain why it is a particular candidate lost and a particular candidate won. And first and foremost, patience is great, but second, blaming is not going to get folks anywhere. What we need is, again, high quality data. And we need, and this is where polls come in, sort of post-election polls, some semblance of allowing respondents to provide a justification for why they did what they did. And so we know that a strong majority of Americans, at least, you know, a majority of Americans supported Donald Trump. So allow them to explain the reasons why that is the case. So we're getting some indication that people really were concerned with the economy and that declarations about how well the economy is doing did not really reflect on the ground experiences. So that's one factor. I think another factor is, you know, a lot of the connections between Harris and Biden, and she was unable to, in large part, distance herself from the Biden administration. And then we can look into whether or not various isms, whether that sexism or racism, played an important role in the lack of support for Harris relative to 2020 and Joe Biden. And so, you know, there are a number of factors that are out there that I think social scientists are going to be looking at, pollsters are going to be looking at it, and pundits are going to be looking at. But we need higher quality data. Exit polls are not really the place to find the answers to the questions that I think we all have.
One of the things that you have talked about and that we have seen, I think you could argue, in the last several election cycles is a frustration with institutions, whether that's higher education, whether that is the media, whether that is the government. And I think in the 2016 cycle, and then again in 2020, polling became one of those institutions, and I'm using air quotes, that was often distrusted by the public. And I wonder how you think it's doable, whether it's doable, to restore confidence in what you do as a pillar of understanding who we are and what we think.
It's a big question. So I would say,
can you first, solve your industry in 30 seconds? Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the first thing is for polling organizations to recognize that one of the issues that the public has is the perception that polling organizations either have an ideological or partisan bent. And so that is the first step, is to communicate that the majority, overwhelming majority of polling organizations have at the heart of their mission to be nonpartisan, non-ideological, and to reflect where the public is. I think the second thing is there needs to be, and we've talked about this previously, a better discussion about the fact that polls are not predictive. I think much of the disdain and the ire that polls and pollsters have been experiencing is this incongruence between what the polls say and then what actually happens. Yeah. But polls are not predictive. They are explanations. They're snapshots of where the public is at that moment in time. And I think, again, it's up to pollsters themselves to do forums like this, to communicate what they do and why they do it, and to be as frank as possible that this is an extremely difficult job, that we do have these challenges in terms of our reputation. We do have these challenges in terms of the ways in which individuals are hesitant to participate in this activity. But it's fundamentally important in a democratic nation to provide information about where the public is at, whether that's on a policy, whether that's on perceptions of where the nation is or where the nation is going, whether that's in terms of how they view outgroups, whether those are racial, ethnic outgroups, gender outgroups, because, you know, the project is an inclusive one. That's what the United States is. And what polls do is to provide that information to elected officials, to the public, to stakeholders, to interest groups, to everyday Americans, so that they know where we are at in order to chart a better way forward.
Satish Nitetta, thank you so much for your time and for talking with me.
Thank you.
Satish Nitetta is the Provost Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the director of the UMass Poll. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell, Patrick Fort, Shayna Roth, and Alyssa Jong Perry. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio for Slate, and TBD is part of the larger What Next family. And hey, now more than ever, we would love your support to keep doing thoughtful, independent journalism. And one of the best things you can do to help us is to join Slate Plus. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. All right, we'll be back next week with more episodes. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.